From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Hey, my appearance on the Fox and Friends on the Fox News channel this Sunday will be pushed back a little bit. They want me to get to Los Angeles for it, so it'll be in several weeks. I'll give you the date when that happens. Here's what's happening. Well. Health officials say the winter flu is just starting to show up in the U.S. That's the seasonal flu, while the swine flu infections, they say, continue to wane, slow down. Swine flu was widespread in only 14 states last week, mostly in the Northeast. That's down from 25 states the week before and 48 in late October. CDC officials said a shortage of swine flu vaccine is easing, with 85 million doses now available if you so choose to get the vaccine. About 98% of the lab-confirmed influenza cases last week, they say, were swine flu, but the CDC also noted seasonal flu is starting up. A deadly winter storm that tortured a wide area of the country for days threatened to drop a foot or more of snow on parts of New York, Pennsylvania, and New England before finally hitting the coast of Maine. Commuters from Des Moines to Chicago braced for more single-digit temperatures, icy roads, while wind chill values as low as negative 25 were forecast for parts of Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. The huge snowstorms battering the U.S. leaves 17 people dead, at least. A story emerging out of Britain suggests follow the money may explain the enthusiasm of the United Nations to pursue caps on carbon emissions, despite doubts surfacing in the scientific community about the validity of the underlying global warming hypothesis. A Mumbai-based Indian multinational conglomerate with business ties to the chairman since 2002 of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change stands to make several hundred million dollars in European Union carbon credits simply by closing a steel production facility in Britain with the loss of 1,700 jobs. WorldNet Daily reporter and author Jerry Corsi on the line with us now. Jerry, sounds like a conflict of interest to me.
Well, George, I think it is. The chairman of this UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, whose name is Rajendra Pakhari, has ties to a top conglomerate in Mumbai, the Tata Group. Tata Group has just closed the Corus steel plant in Great Britain. They're going to cash in somewhere in excess of about $500 million in carbon credits. And Tata Group has close ties to Pakhari. In fact, the Tata Group created the Terry Foundation, which is Pakhari's main employment. So it seems like a very convenient self-dealing and the Tata Group and Pakhari in carbon credits to the detriment of some 1,700 British workers who are going to lose their jobs while Tata Group cashes in on the carbon credits.
And a couple years ago, did not Pakhari share with Al Gore the Nobel Peace Prize for his work on global warming?
Exactly, George. Pakhari and Gore shared the Peace Prize, and when they shared it, this was all for global warming, and Pakhari, in his Nobel lecture, openly represented the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Control. But I think what you've really got here is a mafia, the scientists and business interests, who are cashing in on carbon credits. So when you follow the money, this elaborate scheme of trading and carbon credits is a windfall, not only for the business interests involved, but also for the scientists that are tied to the business interests. And when you follow the money, it seems to me this is a lot less about global warming than it is about scientists getting wealthy.
Unbelievable. The complete story is on WorldNet Daily. Jerry Corsi, what's new with you?
Well, George, my book, America for Sale, is doing quite well. It has been a New York Times bestseller. And I've written a novel, George. I can announce on your show. It'll be out in April.
Really?
It's on the Shroud of Turin. It will be published by Simon & Schuster in April.
Jerry, Thursday I am doing a show on the Shroud. Call producer Lisa. I'd like to get you on for just a little bit, okay?
I'd love to. In fact, I talked to Barry Schwartz today, and he told me he was coming on the show, and I congratulated
him. He's the one.
I think that's great. That's
okay.
Great.
Come on in for a little bit with us next week, okay?
I will.
That's Jerry Corsi, and thanks for your update on this UN climate chief. Unbelievable, huh? The U.S. pays our. Now, that's the guy who determines how much these executives get paid from companies that took TARP money. Well, he has expanded a crackdown on pay packages at four companies rescued with your money, limiting most cash salaries at $500,000 for second tier of top earners. The Treasury Department's Kenneth Feinberg issued the new limits amid outcries from some companies on a government lifeline that they cannot retain or attract key employees, sending the firms racing for bailout exit. He set the compensation structures for the 26th through 100th highest paid employees at these four firms: Citigroup, American International Group, General Motors, and GMAC. Gene Barry, who played the well-dressed man of action in the television series Bat Masterson, Burke's Law, The Name of the Game, has died at the age of 90 of unknown causes. Gene Barry, great actor, essentially played the same character in all three series, which spanned the 1950s to the 70s. Always fashionably dressed, the tall actor with the commanding voice dominated his scenes as he bested the bad guys in each show. In the first of the three, the Western Bat Masterson, he was the frontier guy who rarely resorted to gunplay, choosing instead to beat his rivals senseless with a gold-handled cane. Gene Barry, dead at the age of 90. Science fiction Avatar, the great movie coming out, the first feature film from director James Cameron since Titanic, has had its public premiere in London. Cameron joined stars Sigourney Weaver, Sam Worthington, and Joe Saldana to meet fans ahead of the gala screening. The film, set in the 22nd century on a distant planet, Pandora, inhabited by a humanoid race with its own culture. Reports have suggested the movie cost about $200 million to make. Cameron conceived the story in 1995, and then he waited a decade for technology to simply catch up so he could film it. Up next, Mr. Lobo joins us. Who is Mr. Lobo? Find out in a moment on Coast to Coast Day Out. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Knorr. You're going to love the next 2 hours. Mr. Lobo, host of Cinema Insomnia. It's a nationally syndicated show seen in over 30 television markets. Mr. Lobo has made hundreds of live appearances. He's an advocate for bad movies, but those are in quotes. We'll tell you why. In fact, he claims they're not bad movies, just misunderstood. Here he is on Coast to Coast, Mr. Lobo. Hello,
George,
Mr. Lobo.
George Norrie.
Always a pleasure, Mr. Lobo. How are you?
It's fantastic. Yes, they are not bad movies. In fact, you must open your mind to the possibility that they are not bad movies, just misunderstood.
You know, these movies, since we were kids, have captivated us. Now, tell me about Mr. Lobo. Who the heck are you?
They're still testing. They've done some. They've taken a core sample and they're doing a carbon dating to find out. I am your mysterious host. I'm kind of like a low rent Rod Serling, and I have a dark suit. I got black glasses. I sit in a rocking chair in a void that's somewhere between outer space and the subconscious. And we show you things like Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, and The Brain That Wouldn't Die, and the Brain from Planet Eros, and any other movie with brain in the title probably. And I'm dedicated to the strange and the unusual, and I've also hosted some documentaries. I do a lot of conventions and film festivals, and I can talk to houseplants with my mind, and
you may end up a regular. I think you're going to end up a regular with us. I love what you do.
No good.
It's just and you have. You have looked at so many things that have captivated all of us since we've been kids. We as adults, I think, those that stay childlike just never grow up, and I think you're one of those, aren't you?
Well, it's important to keep, a lot of us, we've got that sleeping child inside of us, and usually we kind of beat it with a stick and keep it under the stairs. But I like
I think it's really important. In fact, the more intelligent you are and the more sophisticated you are, that playtime becomes more and more important. And when we're first learning about the world and when we're in that place of coming of age, you know, when you're 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, you know, you're so curious about the adult world and you're so curious about the dangers of the world. And movies really grab you strong in that period. And your horror host, your horror movie host also becomes a companion and a person who helps you explore all the crazy, wicked, mad, and insane things, the stuff that's on the other side, the stuff that's beyond the beyond. And, you know, we're hungry for it. You know, we're hungry for it, and it fuels our imagination and our spirit and makes us wonder if there's monsters living under our bed. And I think that's good, because maybe there are.
I still can't sleep with my arm over the bed. I can't do it. And you know, listening to this program, who my boyhood idol was and still is, good old Dr. Morgan.
Absolutely. Morgus is legendary in the horror movie host world and is a figure beyond that, because he actually made a motion picture called The Wacky World of Dr. Morgus.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first, I believe, film about a horror movie host, which precedes the Elvira movie by 20 years or more. The very first over-the-air station that I syndicated to was in Louisiana. And they pretty much picked up my show on the strength of the station manager loved Morgus, and he goes, "Oh, you're doing Dr. Morgus's thing. I love it. You know, we'll put you on the air."
That's super.
And every week, I tell you, every week, I would get letters from people going, "Oh, Dr. Lobo." I'm like, "No, I don't have my schooling. I'm Mr. Lobo. You know, you're doing Dr. Morgus, Dr. Morgus." Well, I had to find out what Dr. Morgus was all about, because, you know, by what I was hearing in my fan mail, you would think he went off the air 2 weeks ago, because everyone remembered every detail about his show, all the things that he did, and I had found out that he hadn't been on the air for 20 years or something. And you know, they had done some specials and things where they've taken his wraparounds and tried to build them into individual shows.
I used to rush home when he moved to Detroit for a bit, which is my hometown. I would rush home and watch him. He was first doing special weather cut-ins and weather inserts with Ormsby, his robot.
Ormsby,
and,
yes.
And he had this skull head.
Was he from? Was he still in the ice house making
yes,
his experiments?
Yes, he was in the ice house. And then they started doing the movies and the intros. And on Halloween night, for example, Mr. Lobo, he'd have kids come down to the studio in costume. And as a kid, it was just great. So this was a funny story. I was talking to my producer, Lisa, today. And I said, you know what? It's Friday night. It's a night to do something supernatural and fun and entertaining. I don't want to do the economy tonight, and I just don't want to do any of that. I want to have some fun. And she said, "You're gonna love what I have tonight." And here he is. Now tell me about you're in what, 30 television markets? How do we get you in more markets? Tell me about this.
Well, yes, the syndicator that I'm with is AMG TV. They have their own network of over-the-air broadcast stations. They have about 20 to 30 that are their full-time showing AMG TV programming, and they're all just small independents across the country. But their programming is accessible to any television station that opts in. It goes up on a satellite, and then basically it's barter programming to where the local station gets to keep a portion of the advertising time, and so does the distributor. And you know, it's really remarkable, because you know, I tried to be the local guy. You know, I wanted to be the Dr. Morgus of Northern California, but it's actually very hard to get a show like this on local television stations, and so syndication was really the only way I could do it. I mean, my show doesn't even show 200 miles from where I live, but I'm able to do this kind of a show because someone in Orlando wants to pick up the show,
That's great.
Someone in Dallas wants to pick up the show.
Do you pick the movies for the show?
I do. You know, in the beginning, I worked at an ABC station here in Sacramento, California. And that's how the show started originally, was I was just hosting whatever the movie package of the TV station was. And that's how most of the old school hosts did it. They had no control over what movie they were going to be wrapping around. Now that I produce the show myself, I seek particular films out and I bring them to the show. And, you know, that gives me a lot of leeway with the kind of material we do. It allows me to kind of keep the tone of the show the way I like it and expand it, because now we're even taking in some newer independently made genre films, because I think we're actually entering another golden age of B-movie making in the guise of independent genre films.
Well, look at Paranormal Activity. $15,000 to produce it.
Right.
And the thing does what? $100 million?
Exactly. I mean, that's the success, same success story of Night of the Living Dead, right? I mean, you get a bunch of people in a town go, hey, let's make a movie, and instead of going to the drive-in, it's going on the Netflix, and they're making $1 jillion.
How do you find the movies for your show? Where do you search?
Sometimes they find me.
Really?
Yes, it's interesting. I have a lot of film collector friends. I do a lot of psychotronic film festivals and a lot of strange... I know a lot of film collectors. I know a lot of producers and filmmakers. I have some distribution friends. So sometimes it's like, Mr. Lobo, you got to check out this movie and that sort of thing. A lot of the movies that are on the show are in the public domain. So I'm able to... keep the cost of the show down by doing quite a few films that are no longer licensed. You know, nobody comes running after you if you show Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. So that definitely helps a lot, but it's not exclusive to that. I do I will do a revenue share, or I will give up some of my advertising time, or I will do whatever it takes if I want to license a particular horror film for the show, and really not just horror films, because, I mean, the show is Cinema Insomnia. It's not Dr. Spooky's Castle of Creepiness, you know. So I can do sci-fi, I can do kung fu, I can do really any fun genre fits pretty nicely into the format of the show. I'm not in a castle, and I'm not in a space station. I'm like I said, I'm kind of like Rod Serling and in the Twilight Zone. You know, you didn't know what you were going to get, but you know it was going to be beyond the pale and off the wall, and that's how we like it.
I still have a special feeling for black and white films. How about you?
Absolutely. It's any time you have an abstraction, then that inspires you to use your imagination, and it's very hypnotic. It's very subconscious. Even movies, film versus video. A film is 24 frames per second. Okay,
yeah.
That means half the time you're sitting in a movie theater, you're sitting in the dark, and so your brain is putting all those little. What has magic is what happens in that blackness that happens at a tenth of a second. You know. And you're really putting together the world's fastest comic book, you know. you're reading the movie in your mind, and black and white is like that too, because that color is not there. You're putting your reality into it. You know, it's like looking at an abstract painting. You're called to kind of be pulled into this world, and so the intimacy of a black and white movie has a deep psychological effect. That's my opinion.
Did you do like I did when Aurora came out with those plastic models of the werewolf and the Frankenstein and the Dracula and the monster?
Oh,
did
yes.
you have those?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, they reissued those a jillion times. I think every generation of Monster Kid finds those models. And usually they do what I do. They build them and then they blow them up in their backyard. Or sink them at the bottom of their swimming pool, and then 25 years later they go, "Oh my God, if I still had that, that would be worth money."
I regret not keeping those and all my baseball cards.
Oh,
I had pristine Mickey Mantle cards. And I had it all. Well, stay with us. Mr. Lobo is with us. Well, think back when you were a kid. How did these zany hosts affect you, huh? In their crazy movies. We're going to take your calls next hour with Mr. Lobo. And, of course, this weekend, we've got Coast to Coast AM. And who will host it? None other than Ian Phineas Punnett. Hello, Ian.
I love that. If I were a host like that, I think I would use Phineas. I may use Phineas this weekend.
That's not a bad middle name for you.
That's not. It's better than my real one. So,
did you have a horror host, by the way, fan? Did you love somebody when you were a kid?
I grew up with Creature Features in the Chicago area, and it was sort of unhosted. It had a sort of cartoonish character that would lurk about. There was a guy on Channel 32 in Chicago. So not always the best reception for Sven Gulli, and he was a late night movie host who did a lot of fun stuff. So yeah,
Sven Gulli.
I hear you've got something better going tonight, and I love that. Coming up this weekend, I've got a special thing. Charles Osman, I know you spoke with earlier in the week, and I thank you for the plug because he's coming up on Sunday night, and we'll take a little bit longer with him. And then tomorrow night, in the first hour, they have rediscovered the original CIA field manual, which was thought to have been destroyed completely. It's now reprinted, and Keith Melton will have that in the first hour. And then we'll spend a little time in a real place called Dogtown, Massachusetts. The book is called Dogtown, and it's all about perhaps a cursed community. Is it possible for a landscape to be haunted and to only create sort of the darker side of humanity just out of the very ground on which people walked? We'll talk about that coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast.
Super. Have fun, Ian Punnett. And we'll be back with Mr. Lobo on Coast to Coast AM. Last 30 minutes of the program tonight, Richard C. Hoagland will join us as he is monitoring that bizarre story of that Russian rocket that spiraled around over Norway. But was it that? Richard's working on it. And he'll have a live report for us at the end of the program tonight. We're back with Mr. Lobo. Mr. Lobo, what is a horror host? How did this all start?
Well, you know, I think you're a horror host, George. I mean, live from 27 miles beneath the Earth's crust, it's Gory George Norrie. A horror movie host, you know, we have the tradition in America of the spectral narrator, the person who knows just this much more than you, who takes you into the unknown. And it happened in radio with shows like Lights Out and Inner Sanctum and The Witching Hour. And it also happened in comic books with Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horror, where there's the Crypt Keeper, you know, telling you the story. And when television started, they had, packages of films were coming to TV for the first time, like, you know, King Kong and Son of Frankenstein. And they wanted to have a consistent viewership where people would watch every week. Sure, when King Kong was on, you had ratings through the week, the roof. But the next week, you got The Brain That Wouldn't Die, and you got ratings down in the toilet, you know?
It's like what will happen to golf when Tiger says, as he did today, I'm done for a while. They're going to go right down the tubes.
Exactly. But if you have people watching for the show, if you have people watching week to week to watch that film with their companion, the horror host, then you had consistent ratings. And you know, you're in radio, you know, it's all about ratings. And so
sure is.
They would develop these very zany and very attractive characters, and they would present the movies each week. And it was, again, it was a format that was already out there in spook shows and radio and comics, and it was something that people understood. And it's interesting when you talk to people in other countries, they don't really have it the way that we do. We don't have the sportscaster in the bad Dracula cape introducing the horror movies like we did here in the heydays of television. But what's interesting about it is that, you know, the form has grown and grown. And I think of it as an American folk art, but it's kind of become, there are some major ones, evolutions of it, like Elvira. She was the first national host.
Oh, and a giant. Cassandra Peterson,
whom I know, and she's very supportive of me and has given me a lot of advice.
Super.
And she was the first to go national, and she kind of expanded it in way of becoming a general horror host. You know, she's kind of synonymous with Halloween. A lot of people have never seen her introduce a movie, but they associate her as the person who she's the Santa Claus of Halloween. Her costume is the most popular female costume every Halloween to this day. And she still looks fabulous, and she still does conventions and film festivals and things. And I've done a few film fests with her, and she's just wonderful. And I think Mystery Science Theater also kept the flame going for another generation. People who were in their 20s and younger, or you know, actually people even in their early 30s and younger remember Mystery Science Theater, and that was really kind of a comedic spin on the whole thing. But it's still the same format where you have characters, this time on a space station, who are forced to watch bad movies, but you like those characters, and you come every week, and it doesn't really matter what movie they're showing.
That's true, and you remember science fiction theater as well. My father, Mr. Lobo, would just rush every day. I think it was on Sundays, and it's Sundays in the afternoon, and he would watch it in Detroit. And you know, that's another one of the reasons why I got interested in it, because he'd sit me down. I said, George, watch this. And they would do shows on UFOs and everything else. They were wonderful.
Absolutely, I think two of my most favorite fan episodes aren't even typical genre sci-fi horror films. We have the Bigfoot documentary, Bigfoot Mysterious Monster, and we showed Ancient Astronauts. And you would normally think, okay, these people just want to see sci-fi and horror. They don't want to see a documentary about ancient astronauts. It's all the same audience. They love that stuff.
Yeah, they do. Now, tell me, how did you become the horror host? What happened exactly?
Well, you know, believe it or not, I was raised by a wild pack of film geeks. And I wrote for a magazine called Planet X, and we did a live creature features show where I grew up on a show called Creature Features with Bob Wilkins in the Bay Area, and we wanted to recreate that, a revival. So we had some films on 16mm. We were going to show It Came from Outer Space in 3D and have Bob come and introduce it. And the publisher of the magazine said, hey, you get together with Bob and you know, see if you guys get along, but I want you to write some material with him for this show. So I prepared a lot of material. I made fake VHS boxes of movies, suggested Godzilla movies, like, you know, Three Godzillas and a Baby and Godzilla on Gilligan's Island and all these ridiculous things. And Bob Wilkins, who again hosted Creature Features for 9 years in the Bay Area, he hosted films in Sacramento for 14 years. He encouraged me. He said, you know, you should get out in a chair and do this kind of thing. You should host horror films and host movies. And I couldn't even put my mind around it. I was like, you know, it's like asking me to pick up blacksmithing, you know.
Yeah,
people don't do this kind of thing anymore, you know. This is about you and what you did a long time ago when I was a kid, you know. And it turned out that I, a couple years later, I ended up working at an ABC affiliate in Sacramento, and they had this movie at 3 in the morning that ran 20 minutes short. And they didn't know how to fill the time, so they just jammed it with, like, promos and PSAs. They'd have like 6 minutes
over and over,
yes,
right?
The same ones, 6 and 8 minute commercial breaks with just the same promos and PSAs. And I said, have you ever tried to watch a 6 minute commercial break? And have you ever tried to watch a six minute commercial break filled with nothing but PSAs? You know, I think I could help you fill this time in the middle of the night. And really, to be honest, they didn't really care. It was just they felt it was probably something that would lift morale at the station to let us do it. But I had some confidence because Bob encouraged me and encouraged my writing. And so we just went into craziness. We went from a dead stop to week to week to week putting out. We did 22 episodes in a row.
That's huge.
Week to week to week. And I did an average of about 18 wraparounds for the movie. And And at the end of 22 weeks, it was starting to get mail, and we were starting to get phone calls, and we thought we were doing good. But, you know, they only liked it because it was on the under the radar. When the more people liked it, then they had to decide if it matched their corporate image, or if it was something they really wanted to own, or maybe they should put one of their producers on the show.
And they probably said, "And these guys are going to want some money pretty soon."
Yeah, that too. And so I really kind of I went up to the general manager and I said, "Do you remember all those hoops I went through to do this show for you guys? Is it okay if I jump backwards through all those hoops and produce the show independently of the station and syndicate it on my own?" And they said, "You know what? We don't have any hold on the show. We don't really care. And as long as you don't use any of the shows that you made here, you can do whatever you want." So I just started over. At that time, Consumer Video, this is 2002 or 3, Consumer Video was at a point where you could actually make a show in your backyard and have it look pretty decent. So I just started producing the shows myself, and the first station that picked it up was a cable station in Virginia. And it ran there for about half a year, and then it got picked up in Louisiana, which was used to play Morgus's shows, and I told you about that. And it just grew a station at a time. Then a syndicator picked it up. We were with the UATV network, which put us in 30 cities. And then I got back. I actually found someone closer to home in the San Francisco Bay Area. KTEH picked it up for about 3 years. And then now I'm with AMGTV, and they serve 100 affiliates plus with their programming, plus it goes into cable and all that. And I'm on online at cinemainsomnia.com. In fact, the show is streaming right now if people want to watch it, while they're listening to Coast, of course.
Of course.
I have 24 DVDs that are on Amazon, and I do conventions and film fests, and I'm having a ball. There was a need for it. There was a void.
We've got to get you picked up by a satellite network somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, would this work for radio?
A horror host? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we got to get you to talk to our people at the network.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be a fun little thing to do.
You could introduce old radio plays like Escape and Suspense, and you could do the same format on radio quite easily.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Tell me some of your favorite movies, whether they're horror films or just regular kind.
Oh,
gosh.
Well, you know, probably, and this is going to sound perverse, but probably my favorite film of all time is Plan 9 from Outer Space. It's considered the worst movie of all time. And I am just so in love with it. It's so charming. I love seeing the cardboard tombstones and the spinning models on strings for spaceships. And you know, I really enjoy that a lot. I really enjoy that film a great deal. I do think Son of Frankenstein is probably my favorite good horror film. The Invisible Man is way up there too. I think the performance in that movie from Claude Rains, his voice is just so incredible. It just grabs hold of you. I like a lot of cult movies, too. I like Brazil, Terry Gilliam's Brazil. I like, Death Race 2000. I like a lot of really strange movies.
Do you remember in a film called The Mysterians?
Yes.
That was a classic, too.
Yes, I mean, absolutely.
A lot of those came out of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess after World War II and after the atomic bombs were dropped, they went into this mode of making these horror creature movies,
right,
based on radiation and fallout and what would happen.
Well, you know, all monsters are based on what we're afraid of, and all monsters are metaphors, you know, and they were really working out a lot of things that were in their subconscious. And when you have a couple atomic bombs dropped on you, you know, the idea of a radioactive monster destroying cities, you know, that's a theme that really has a lot more depth to it, you know.
What was the name of the movie with the monster ants?
Them.
Yes, that one freaked me out.
Yes. Them is another one. Radiation always made things bigger. You know, Amazing Colossal Man and the 50-foot woman and all of those things. It's always the radiation that makes things larger.
Let's talk about some of the hosts. The home run hosts. Most of them were all local then, right?
Originally, yes. It was odd because it was a national phenomenon, but it happened locally. The stories are so similar. In every market that my show airs, I get letters from people telling me about the guy they saw when they were 8 years old, and it's the same story. And a lot of these guys never saw each other's shows, so it's amazing how similar, how many mad scientists and how many vampires and how many vampire women and how many things were the same.
Morgus was telling me a couple years ago when he came to see us here in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
He always talked with this very funny darn talk to us.
I would love to meet him. Does he wear the fake teeth all the time? That's what I would.
Yeah,
want.
He does. I'm not sure they're fake.
Oh.
I did a routine once where he said he could put up a force field, uh-huh. and he told me to hit him in the face,
uh-huh.
and I didn't want to, but he insisted, and I knocked out one of his teeth.
Oh, wow.
But he told me this incredible story. You'd appreciate it.
Okay.
He came to L.A. Some writers called him in and looked at his script idea.
Right.
Of this zany, mad scientist,
mm-hmm.
with the zany hair and the buck teeth, and he talked funny. And they took his information, they thanked him, and they never called him back.
Oh.
And what happened? Jerry Lewis and the Absent-Minded Professor.
Oh, no.
Yep. He is convinced the same people did that. They took his idea, they rewrote the script, and they went out and got Jerry Lewis.
Well, that's exactly what happens in Hollywood. I mean, basically, the second you leave the room, they're on the phone going, how do we steal this? And only if the answer is we can't, that's when they come to you and try to work some sort of deal.
Ian mentioned in the Chicago area, Sven Gulli. Who was he?
Sven Gulli, yes. There were two Sven Gullis. The original Sven Gulli was Jerry Bishop, and he was like a hippie. And he had like a psychedelic coffin, and he would kind of stagger out of it, and he'd make a lot of drug references and stuff. And he ended up moving to San Diego and handing it off to Rich Kaz, who played it more like an undertaker. We had a tall top hat and the dark circles around the eyes. And they always have gags with rubber chickens just all the time. They always have the person who comes to the door, and you don't see who they are. You just see their hand gesticulating. And they've got all these inside gags. It's really marvelous. But it's like 30 years of this in the Chicago area with Sven Gulli and then son of Sven Gulli who became Sven Gulli. So, Rich Kaz is amazing. I mean, it's unfortunate that he's stuck in the Chicago area. You know, the station where he's on is kind of proprietary, and they don't syndicate it. So unless you live in Indiana, parts of Indiana or Chicago,
you don't really get
to see it. And he is absolutely professional and first rate, and he is still doing it to this very day. Every week he's making up kooky songs. He's doing full skits with characters, and he's showing you Hell Comes to Frogtown or whatever movie they've got.
That's great. I know in Detroit, in addition to Morgus, we had a guy on by the name of Sir Graves Gastly.
Absolutely.
He'd come out of a coffin.
He was in a documentary that I did.
Was he? How about let's pop around the country and see see who these people are.
Sure.
Zachary in New York.
Yes, Zachary was in New York. He was originally named Roland in Philadelphia. And he was also an undertaker. They had a Western a Western soap opera that they filmed live in the afternoons, and he was the undertaker on the Western. So it was just the only costume that he had was the undertaker outfit, and he would be barefoot in a coffin, and he would cast glances to this laundry cart where his dismembered wife supposedly lived and talked to it. And he had a big amoeba made out of jello that he would split open and dissect, and it would have like spaghetti noodles and eggs for eyeballs and all these things that he would pull out of it. And marvelous improvisational. He did a ton of novelty records in the 60s. He ran for president. He uh, He was a radio DJ. He's appeared on television shows. They imitate him on the Flintstones.
We should have elected him. We'll be back. We'll talk more about some of these hosts from all over the country, and we'll open up the phone lines because we want you to share your stories on how some of these horror hosts affected you as a kid. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.